From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We can't add much to the outpouring of remembrances and praise marking the death Tuesday of Washington Post's Katharine Graham, the age of 84. She was an icon of journalism and business for many reasons, most famously for her fateful defiance of the Nixon administration on both the Pentagon Papers and Watergate. Here she is speaking to NPR's Linda Wertheimer in 1997 about the experience of going nose to nose with the White House.
The company was really at risk. They were verbally threatening us every day and attacking us and attacking our credibility, which is all a paper has, really.
But that wasn't all the Washington Post Company had. It also had broadcast licenses worth tens of millions of dollars, which the administration was threatening to revoke. Many of Kay Graham's eulogists have marveled at her remarkable transition from doting doormat wife, to use her word, to activist publisher chairwoman of one of the most successful media companies in the world. What's seldom mentioned is how Mrs. Graham's bravery and her circumstances intertwined. The fact that she controlled what was essentially a family business itself enabled her to face down the administration.
These days, as we watch dubious libel suits settled out of court, heavy layoffs whenever ad revenues dip, and increasingly entertainment-driven editorial matter, it's hard for us to imagine mega media corporate owners risking their assets, as Mrs. Graham did, on a journalistic bet. Maybe her greatest legacy was her understanding that, in a media company, fiduciary interest to the shareholders is not about avoiding short-term risk, but nurturing and protecting the journalistic goose that lays the golden egg.
Outside pressures, from ratings to advertising to corporate ownership by AOL Time Warner, have certainly affected the fortunes of CNN. When new CNN chairman and CEO Walter Isaacson worked at Time Magazine, people said that 24-hour cable news was making magazines obsolete. Now people are saying that the Internet is making 24-hour cable news irrelevant. There are more than a few challenges facing the man who took over the network on July 9th, or in CNN terms, day 69 of the Chandra Levy story. Walter Isaacson, welcome to OTM.
It's good to be here.
First, let's get the dirty stuff out of the way. The competition is very tough, especially from Fox News Channel. Shrinking ad revenue, or in the middle of an advertising recession, shrinking audience. Are you sure you wanted this job?
Well, first of all, the competition is from about 200 channels, and it is a very bad ad recession, but I think it's somewhat of a myth that the audiences are shrinking. The audience for news is actually growing on cable, and even the general household audiences of CNN are holding up okay. But you're right, we are challenged on ratings, and I think one of the challenges is not just to chase ratings at all costs, but gather an audience of people who are interested in smart, honest, credible information. And I think if we gather the audience for that, there'll be enough of an audience, and there'll be enough advertisers who want that type of audience.
Chandra Levy. Mm-hmm. A week ago Thursday, the campaign finance bill had just stalled in the House after a procedural vote. Campaign finance is pretty big news, or it could be.
I think it's
big
news. Fascinating news, and I think it can be made fascinating. And yes, I'm sure if you looked at 2:33 in the afternoon, whatever, there's a lot of Chandra Levy stuff. But we did a very good special on Inside Politics from 5 to 6 p.m., and when the stem cell research was debated and the families came up with stem cell research, we spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill on that. But you're right. We've got to make the other news as compelling as the Chandra Levy type news.
Permit me just to rub your nose in this a little bit more. On Inside Politics, yes, campaign finance was the subject, but show led with Chandra Levy. CNN First Evening News, police continued the search for Chandra Levy. I'm reading from your rundowns. CNN Crossfire, who killed campaign finance reform? God bless them. CNN Burden of Proof, should Levy investigation be focused on conduct? CNN Larry King Live, the investigation into the disappearance of Chandra Levy. CNN The Point with Greta Von Sustern, 73 days and counting about Chandra Levy. Wolf Blitzer, D.C. police expand the search for Chandra Levy or her remains. And To your credit, and especially to his, the Jeff Greenfield Show, Greenfield at Large, Stem Cells and Scandals. That's a lot of Chandra Levy.
That is a lot of Chandra Levy. And what you have to do is say, look, where are we going to try to do different stuff? I'm not going to make any apologies, though, for drawing viewers in who might want the latest on Chandra Levy. I think you have to look for ways to make other stories as compelling to viewers as Chandra Levy naturally might be. In the meantime, though, I think it's easy for me to go on NPR and pretend to hold my nose about that story. But I think that that story is valid and interesting, and we should try to make other stories feel equally interesting.
Well, I think, you know, I'm just as eager to find out how this is going to turn out as everybody else. But I also understand that if, you know, I'm completely flummoxed as how to pursue it until till some news appears, and just the endless speculation and hypotheticals and supposing and what ifs that fill up at least 90% of these cable hours. You know, it's infuriating to me.
I think all news organizations might be born with the DNA from the primordial soup out of which they evolved, just like Nightline sort of was from the hostage crisis in Iran, and CNN was from the big news events like the Persian Gulf War and Middle East wars, and the Fox News Network was pretty much came into its own with impeachment when there was a lot of ideological divisiveness. And likewise, there's been that period where all cable news hounds were chasing the same, you know, animals and sort of jumping on JonBenet or jumping on OJ or jumping on those sort of things. And I think maybe the time for that has passed as well. And what we have to do is have, you know, intelligent people who can tell those type of journalistic tales and maybe hook audiences again.
News organizations do great when there's a war. They get a lot of audience. When the Gulf War was being fought, CNN, you know, fabulous ratings. O.J. Simpson, CNN, fabulous ratings. Is there a tendency or a temptation to try to inflate ordinary stories or, say, less significant stories with the same kind of drama to interest an audience and, you know, kind of cheapen journalism in the process?
Well, yes, there is. There is a temptation when you've got a lot of newsprint or airtime to fill, perhaps to hyperinflate things. And one of the things I've been discussing in our news meetings is let's take some of the more significant stories that are actually very interesting and find ways to make them more exciting. Let's make the idea of embryos and stem cell research and the decision people have to make on that issue as interesting as the other decisions that get hyped on cable news.
Maybe stem cell research needs a graphic and some theme music.
Stem cell research needs to be made both personal and to the deep moral issue that it is.
Have you spoken to Ted Turner since you got this job?
Oh, yes. I've spoken to him quite a bit.
He's kind of famously disaffected and about the path of, you know, his baby, CNN. Did he give you any advice or marching orders?
Well, Ted Turner was a real visionary to start this network, and he pleaded with me to get it back to great journalism. He has certain strong political beliefs that I don't fully share, and nor do I think the network should promote, and I explained that to him, and I think he realizes he has no editorial involvement in the network, but does want it to continue to be known for great reporting.
Walter Isaacson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Walter Isaacson is the chairman and chief executive of the CNN News Group.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of Catcher in the Rye, and J.D. Salinger is still in hiding. Who could blame him? He created an icon, and people have behaved as they usually do with icons, worshiping, identifying, distorting, and smashing. Here is Will Smith playing the seductive fraud in John Guare's Six Degrees of Separation, taking the hammer to Holden.
Everybody's a phony. Page 2, my brother's in Hollywood being a prostitute. Page 3, what a phony slob his father was. Page 9, people never notice anything. On page 89, I'd rather push a guy out the window or chop his head off with an axe, then sock him in the jaw. I hate fist fights. What scares me most is the other guy's face.
Some critics say that J.D. Salinger set the template for the modern teenager, that Holden Caulfield begat Brando in The Wild Ones and James Dean in Everything, not to mention the parade of adolescent protagonists that followed, that he also inspired such notorious shooters as Mark David Chapman and John Hinckley, Arthur Bremer and Robert Bardot, is not so hard to fathom. The use and abuse of Holden Caulfield could have been predicted. In fact, it was. In a review back in 1951, Christian Science Monitor critic T. Morris Longstreth found the character, quote, pathetic beyond belief, and he went on, one fears that a book like this, given wide circulation, may multiply his kind, as too easily happens when immorality and perversion are recounted by writers of talent. Even Holden himself saw it coming. He said, people always clap for the wrong things. If I were a piano player, I'd play in the goddamn closet. So for decades, Salinger has played in the closet, leaving millions of us with the sonata that is Catcher in the Rye, to play at a tender age as the soundtrack for our Holden-like rages and bad behavior. Mostly, though, we don't resort to murder and mayhem to show our contempt for phonies. We probably suspect that, like Holden, we are unreliable narrators, not altogether devoid of phoniness ourselves. Some of us may have even seen ourselves as the critic Longstreth saw Holden, pathetic beyond belief. There is a stage in life when we scare ourselves. We're scared of our weirdness and scared of our normality. Holden made his readers, whether model citizen or murderer, feel ennobled by the struggle.
Big Holden Caulfield fan?
No. Not really.
You just like the story?
No, not especially, no.
Well, Jerry, you've got a dozen copies of this book.
I know. There's more of them in here. And under the bed. I don't know why, but whenever I see one, I have to buy it. And if I don't see one, well, then I have to find one to buy so that I feel normal.
Coming up, media mogul Michael Bloomberg trolls for voters, media darling Henry Kissinger strolls past accusers, and how the developers of the new artificial heart ticked off the science press.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On May 28th, Henry Kissinger was summoned to appear before a French court. He was called as a witness in an investigation of five French citizens who disappeared under the rule of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. He was to be asked about Operation Condor, a terror network set up by seven South American governments that the United States was long suspected of having supported. Kissinger, who was in Paris at the time, was under no legal obligation to respond, so he didn't. Soon after, Kissinger hit the talk shows on a book tour, with PBS's Charlie Rose, CNN's Wolf Blitzer, Fox News Channel's Paul Azan. He went to the National Press Club. No one asked him about the French subpoena. On MSNBC, Brian Williams did challenge Kissinger by asking him to respond to a charge levied against him in a polemical new book by Christopher Hitchens. The broad accusation prompted a broad dismissal from the former Secretary of State.
Christopher Hitchens, as you no doubt know, is out with a new book called The Trial of Henry A. Kissinger. It is very rough on you. It is a book devoted to criticism of you. It contends you were a double agent during the 1968 presidential
campaign. Yeah, I know these charges, and I'm not going to deal with Christopher Hitchens. He's collected everything that's ever been said, has given it his own twist. He's a man who's attacked Mother Teresa, Jackie Kennedy. He said the Holocaust never existed. And I'm not going to do him the favor of getting into a debate with him.
All right. Well, we have you on record then.
Obviously, you felt you didn't need to follow up on that.
Well, yeah. We were just going to get into a morass at that point. As a journalist, you are on live television, and you have before you the live grenade of an accusation that there is a journalist who is a Holocaust denier. And were we to take that next step, it would have compounded itself.
Hitchens called that accusation slander and has threatened to sue. But Kissinger swats away his critics like so many gnats. Brian Williams.
Look, there are a goodly number of Americans who spend each day in this country believing Henry Kissinger is an unindicted war criminal. Should Henry Kissinger answer for either perceived past sins or reasons why his name may be in the news today? Yes. I think everyone needs to understand, though, there's a time and place for everything, and we have to all keep it in context and perspective.
Kissinger's French subpoena wasn't reported in the news pages of the Washington Post or the Los Angeles Times. In the New York Times, it appeared in a single line at the end of a related story a month after it happened. It has not been heard in a news report on National Public Radio. Kirk Kortlar, a copy editor at the New York Times, said the story fell through the cracks because the Paris correspondent wasn't there to confirm it. Washington Post foreign editor Phil Bennett and Los Angeles Times foreign editor Simon Lee told us that simply there was no news there. They declined our request for a radio interview. NPR's foreign editor Lauren Jenkins did explain.
So far, I don't think it really has risen to the level of seriousness to cover it.
The same, he says, holds true for Kissinger's summons last month by a court in Chile to answer questions related to the disappearance of an American filmmaker shortly after the 1973 coup led by Pinochet.
We have known for 30 years what Kissinger did. Now, some people interpret those as violations of human rights, as war crimes, and some don't. I think if there was an official request for extradition from one of these governments or one of these judiciaries in Chile or France. Right now, what you have is a bunch of independent magistrates with no international authority whatsoever raising these questions. I don't see this as a major bit of news.
I think that's not the way we would look at it.
Robert Thompson is the managing editor of the Financial Times, which has run short pieces on the French and Chilean summonses. So have The Guardian and The Irish Times and newspapers in France and the Netherlands and South America, among others.
Certainly history is generally in past tense. But what you do have very clearly now is an issue about responsibility for actions beyond your borders and what are the legal rights for those who feel that they have genuine grievances against them. I would argue that that is not history. That's very much present tense.
The Kissinger story is noteworthy in Europe, says Thompson, not because of Kissinger, but because of the issues it raises. Noteworthy in Britain, he says, because that nation was compelled by a foreign government to take Pinochet into custody, and in Europe in general, because it's the site of the International War Crimes Tribunal.
The Kissinger case has been made more theatric by the writings of Christopher Hitchens and his book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. But really, the subpoenas involving Mr. Kissinger are not so much about Mr. Kissinger himself, but about this more fundamental issue of responsibility for events and the ability of particular court systems to take action, whether that be for something that happened 15 years ago or 5 years ago or 2 years ago.
Washington Post columnist Richard Cohn suspects part of the reason the Post may not have picked up the subpoena story is that a kind of fatigue has set in after more than a generation of Kissinger bashing.
He's always been criticized, to no avail. I mean, it isn't as if the criticism has stopped him. The charges have slowed him up, and he went from success to success to success. much to the annoyance of his critics. I think after a while, people sort of tune it out.
He says that's just a guess, but if it were up to him, he'd run the story.
I'm not going to defend it. I mean, I think we should have written about it. But, you know, a lot of things fall through the cracks about all newspapers, and that even includes the Washington Post. I'm sure if you looked at it, you would find no reason for it, except that on the day that the story was supposed to run, something else knocked it off, and then somebody forgot about it. It kills conspiracy theories.
So those are some of the explanations and a little of the speculation on why, for the most part, the summoning of Henry Kissinger was not deemed fit to print. Still, the story is trickling out. It made the Boston Globe a month after it happened. It hit Newsday and USA Today this week. Also this week, after a speech in San Francisco, an audience member asked Kissinger to talk about the war crimes accusations that have dogged him for so long. Kissinger said that they are untrue, reckless, and that the article by Christopher Hitchens, in which they appeared, is contemptible. Here in New York, we're in the midst of a relatively mundane mayoral campaign, but we have one thing all those other cities haven't got. A genuine media mogul is in the race. Michael Bloomberg owns a business information service, a syndicated television service, a radio network, and a wire service. But being a media mogul doesn't mean you can handle the media, as On the Media's Andrea Bernstein reports.
It's not an overstatement to say Michael Bloomberg revolutionized the business world. In the 1980s, he started offering instant information to Wall Street traders from a customized computer that made the so-called Bloomberg box a must-have. Coverage in the business press was laudatory. Words like genius, brilliant, and unique peppered the prose. But being a media mogul hasn't prepared him for dealing with the political press.
We try to get everybody at least one question, so it's just fair.
Unlike other candidates in this race who chase microphones, Bloomberg literally runs from them.
Just put it right in my mouth, please. I mean, just a little bit of space, thank you very much. It's called courtesy.
The tabloids have had a field day with off-the-cuff Bloomberg comments like, the mayor's job isn't 24 hours a day, and one about high school students having a problem with personal hygiene. So Bloomberg and his aides have been trying to keep a lid on reporters' questions. That makes for poor candidate press relations.
And I will continue to do it. And thank you very much for today. I think you've had enough questions.
If you see yourself in that tradition, you mentioned the
candidate. Like most rich men, he's stingy about releasing his tax returns. The other candidates gave full access. But the Bloomberg campaign only allowed reporters 5 hours to review mock-ups of his returns contained in 4-inch-thick binders. Then they took the binders back. The actual numbers were deleted from the forms, replaced instead with categories of amounts. G, for example, meant more than $500,000. The New York Times tried to bring a photocopier in. It was rejected. The New York Daily News tried to come back with an accountant. That, too, was rejected. And it wasn't until this reporter got into a confrontation with Bloomberg's spokesman that he handed out lists of Bloomberg's charitable contributions for the last 4 years.
I've told every single source of revenue, every single deduction, and my tax rates. After that, it's just nosiness on your part.
Not so nosy are the reporters who work for Bloomberg News, Bloomberg Television, and Bloomberg Radio.
Yeah, covering the mayor's race for us is problematic, simply because one of the candidates happens to be Mike Bloomberg, happens to be the owner of this company.
Bloomberg News director Matthew Winkler says the news service is avoiding covering the mayor's race as much as possible.
It's incumbent upon us, whenever we're writing about anything remotely linked to Bloomberg, the company, or Bloomberg, the man, to probably have the most perfunctory coverage we could have, which is essentially nouns and verbs and minus many of the superlatives.
But if Bloomberg's relationship with the press is a source of complaints from reporters and concern from media critics, it's largely irrelevant to voters. They get most of their information about candidates from radio and TV ads. Bloomberg is buying those at a rate of $1 million a week.
My father was a hard-working accountant for a local dairy. He died when I was in college, so my mother went back to work as a secretary. I started a financial information and news company in a one-room office.
20 years later, we're in 126 countries with over 7,000 full-time employees.
And Bloomberg's paid media message is getting through.
Have you seen Bloomberg's television ads?
How could you miss it?
Seen a lot of them.
I haven't seen it.
How could you miss it? Every channel, every station is there.
At a Queens senior center recently, another woman, Hilda Peltz, had near-perfect recall. That's gold for any campaign.
I saw how he started when he was a little boy, and then when he came home, his father died early, and he's a self-made man. He made all the millions, and now they're opening up in different places, and he's so big now. He must be a trillionaire now.
What did you think of him? You think you might vote for him?
I don't know. I'm not a Republican, if that's so. That makes me ready, Larry.
Mr. Bloomberg says he's learning how to be a candidate, getting better at it.
How do you like dealing with reporters these days?
I love it. Every bit of it.
All right, thanks, guys.
Getting better at it?
So you'll write something about it and say,
come on, guys.
If Bloomberg becomes mayor, and polls show that's still a long shot, we might be writing less. He said as mayor he wouldn't hold the usual daily press conference. He suggested moving Room 9, that's where City Hall reporters sit, to Staten Island, a boat ride away from City Hall. For On the Media, I'm Andrea Bernstein in New York.
Bloomberg may not love the media, but according to Brian Lehrer, host of WNYC's On the Line, the media are infatuated with him.
Yes, infatuated with billionaire candidate Michael Bloomberg, who's being covered more like a movie star than a politician. Let's take the New York Times as a case study. You can forgive the front page Sunday style section spread called Bloomberg and the A-List, the Mutual Hug. It was the style section, after all. But what about the substance sections? The same day's Week in Review graced us with Maureen Dowd's hard-hitting column titled From Bloomberg with Love, from which we can glean a host of useful voter information items, like he loves James Bond, and he goes to the opera with Beverly Sills. Thank you, Maureen Dowd. I'm almost ready to vote now. I just have to check the People magazine endorsement. Just how much is Bloomberg dominating coverage of the race? I did a search on the New York Times website of all articles in the month of June with the word Bloomberg in the headline. Count 19. Headlines containing the name of Mr. Bloomberg's opponent in the Republican primary? 4. Which is exactly the problem with this kind of coverage. Bloomberg isn't an abstraction. He's running against someone. You just have a hard time figuring that out from reading the New York Times. The someone, by the way, is Herman Badillo, the city's first Latino commissioner, borough president, deputy mayor, and city university chairman. He is arguably more conservative than Michael Bloomberg and could be appealing to many Republican primary voters if they get to hear or read about him. But will they? I searched the Times website again. Last 10 articles containing the words Herman Badillo anywhere in the text. Of those 10 articles, only 2 had the name Badillo in the headline. 3 contained the name Bloomberg in the headline. The only actual news story about Badillo came when he accused Bloomberg of a campaign dirty trick. Why does this happen? Because Badillo is old, Puerto Rican, a failed mayoral candidate in the past? No, there seems to be a pattern of infatuation where the candidate is new and filthy rich. Through Election Day last year, during the U.S. Senate race from New Jersey, the Times ran 85 articles with the name of self-financed millionaire newcomer John Corzine in the headline, just 35 with the name of Republican candidate Congressman Bob Franks. So I have a media strategy for Mr. Badillo. Campaign only in terms of Michael Bloomberg. Call yourself the un-Bloomberg. Don't announce an education plan. Claim you have one that's better than Bloomberg's. And you know his autobiography, Bloomberg by Bloomberg? Write an op-ed piece about your own life called Badillo by Badillo and submit it to the New York Times. The Bloomberg literary reference just might get it in.
Brian Lehrer is the host of WNYC's On the Line and the former host of On the Media. Earlier this month, medical history was made when the first self-contained artificial heart was implanted in a human being. If the company that developed the device had its way, however, you still might not know about it. That's because Abiomed, the makers of the AbioCore artificial heart, reserved the right for a 30-day quiet period to ensure, they said, patient privacy.
The patient's name is still not known, but a few details are. The Associated Press broke the story the day after the heart had been implanted, but the medical team was less than forthcoming. Questions to the Louisville Jewish Hospital, where the surgery took place, were directed to Abiomed. Abiomed, based in Massachusetts, has plenty of technicians who can tell you how the heart works, but only the physicians in Louisville know how the patient is doing.
By last week, the New York Times medical correspondent had had enough. Dr. Lawrence Altman wrote a scathing article quoting doctors and ethicists who all agreed that the blackout wasn't serving the public. Since then, the doctors have agreed to give periodic updates and hold occasional news conferences. Dr. Altman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What do you think motivates a decision to call a news blackout by the manufacturer of a new medical device?
I suspect, as the critics have said, that there are business reasons for it. And the ethicists have pointed out how that can help the company by minimizing any potential bad news, and if there's good news, presenting it without the background of negative events. On the other hand, it tends to oversimplify the way the research was done, because you would just hear the end product just as if it had been published in a journal without the details as it went through.
Do you think that covering health developments somehow falls into a different category, requires a different standard of openness than other sorts of business news?
I think the public has a greater right to know, because the public financed a large portion of the development of the artificial heart through the National Institutes of Health, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Abiomed received millions of dollars from those grants and has received millions more from investors. And we are talking about the leading cause of death in the United States, which is heart disease.
And do you think this will have an impact on how the public then perceives these operations? Do you think it will create an unnatural clamor, unnatural expectations, all the sorts of things that Abiomed apparently fears?
No, I think it will be an educational experience for the public, and they will see the rocky course that goes on, how long it may take for recovery, the obstacles along the way, and the problems that are encountered. I mean, I think there is clearly patient confidentiality, which is an issue, but that's one that can be dealt with before somebody joins an experiment. The individual who participates in an experiment, ethicists say, is doing it not just for that individual's benefit, but for society's benefit, and therefore gives up a certain degree of privacy. After all, it was the company's publicity in the beginning that led to the selection of this patient. This man read an article in Newsweek that resulted from the publicity that Abiomed put out, and that man asked his cardiologist if he might not be a candidate, and the cardiologist thought it over and said, yes, that was a good suggestion, and called Jewish Hospital, and that's how the patient was referred here.
Dr. Lawrence Altman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Lawrence Altman is the senior medical correspondent for the New York Times. The full text of Abiomed's response to Dr. Altman's article can be found on our website, onthemedia.org.
Coming up, dogs are all over the movies, sharks are all over the cable news, and we'll be all over your letters. Plus, how employee buyouts are affecting newspaper journalism.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Due to a drop in ad revenues, newspapers nationwide are going under the knife, and the staffs of newsrooms are getting smaller and younger. Some staffers have been laid off, but most of the reductions have come through voluntary buyout offers of early retirement. From WBUR in Boston, Monica Brady looks at how readers are affected by the buyouts.
The deals are typically offered to employees with at least 10 years of experience and higher salaries and benefits, the most expensive employees, and the prime targets for buyouts when corporate owners seek to shave costs. These are invariably the reporters and editors with the most experience.
What's going on in journalism today is insane.
These used to be valued employees, laments Jim Naughton, president of the Poynter Institute, a journalism think tank based in Florida.
Companies that have for decades been working to build up the credibility and ability of their staffs are now spending lots of money to buy them out, send them away to do God knows what, so that they can impress Wall Street with a better bottom line.
The Philadelphia Inquirer lost 100 people last fall in a buyout and expects another 200 people to leave during another round of offers going on right now. Those who left include many of the editors who were centrally involved in the work that won the paper 18 Pulitzers over the last few decades. At the Baltimore Sun, 86 people took the buyout last fall, and there's another offer going on now. The Miami Herald and the San Jose Mercury News are also offering buyouts. At the Boston Globe, a New York Times-owned paper, nearly 200 employees took the golden handshake last month. Almost 70 of them were reporters, editors, photographers, and others from the newsroom. Richard Gullah is a spokesman for the Boston Globe.
It's an industry-wide problem. I mean, if you look across the country, if you look at papers in the Gannett chain, in the Knight Ritter chain, and just about every other paper in the country, the drop-off in advertising was very steep and very sudden, and that's what led to a lot of these cutbacks.
Both Knight Ritter and Gannett have seen smaller profits, but the average in the newspaper industry is still about 21%. Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, says it's hard to judge the effects of buyouts on the quality of a paper.
The question is, at what point does the public notice that your paper is produced by fewer and younger people? The problem is that you never know where that point is. It's not a black and white line.
At the Boston Globe, the area of coverage hardest hit seems to be health and science. Larry Tai spent 15 years mostly writing about medicine. Tai said he was delighted to take the buyout so he could work on his third book. He says by his accounting, in the past year, the Globe has lost around 100 years of medical writing experience. This includes two veteran reporters who left before the buyout and three who took the buyout.
I think overall it will take time to see whether the paper is improved or weakened by the buyouts. Clearly, when you lose a lot of people, I think there is a sense that that has to hurt. I hope that over time they'll replace the people who are critical and that readers won't notice any difference.
The Globe also lost its health science editor. Scott Allen is the new editor. He's reported on the environment for the paper for 8 years.
I would prefer to think of it as less of a brain drain than a changing of the guard. It's a very different department now, there's no question about it. But story for story, the things you'll see in the paper now are certainly as good as anything we were doing before.
Buyouts not only change the makeup of the newsroom, they upset a community of sources that have long-standing relationships with reporters. Medical sources in Boston say the buyouts in the health science section leave a gaping hole. Andrew Dreyfus, now president of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation, is a longtime Globe source for medical stories.
I think the fear in the healthcare community is that we won't have that kind of comprehensive coverage that we've come to enjoy. I think, you know, the Globe has a national reputation for a lot of reasons, but I think one of the sources of its national reputation has been the strength and diversity of its healthcare coverage.
Two of the newer reporters on the section have not covered health and science before. Former Globe science reporter Richard Saltis, who took the buyout, says they'll have to grapple with a lack of historical memory.
There's so much research that comes across your desk every day in journals and press releases and at meetings and so on. And where it really helps to have been there for a while is to have a sense of where this new piece of research fits in with things that have been done over the years.
But in news departments across the country, papers have lost older reporters with the experience to put breaking news in context. Eliminating this expertise isn't a smart business choice, says Tom Rosensteel of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He says newspaper publishers are entirely too focused on short-term Wall Street margins.
What newspapers arguably should be doing at this point is not eliminating jobs at the newspaper to save money, but should be investing in new products, entirely new products, that will attract a new generation of customers.
As readers age and circulation drops, Rosenstiel says papers don't have to sacrifice experience to make a younger, edgier product. For On the Media, I'm Monica Brady in Boston.
Now we'd like to take a moment to answer some of your letters. In response to our plugs for listener feedback, we got this email from a G. Chamomile. It says, I am amused and bored at the same time when I hear that journalists want to hear from their listeners or readers. If they receive positive comments, they bask in the glow of the accolades and know that they are performing a service for society. If they receive brickbats, they respond with an array of comments like, I'm just doing my job.
Sorry, G. Chamomile, we're just doing our job. Talking of criticism, listener Catherine Bromberg had this to say about OTM's interview with the publisher of Found Magazine. I must object, she writes, to the patronizing tone of the reporter, that would be me, who interviewed David Rothbart about his magazine, which consisted of Found writings. The reporter spent roughly half the interview telling Mr. Rothbart he was invading people's privacy and would likely be sued, except that he had no money. Many fine artists have made well-respected names for themselves by compiling found objects into a larger whole.
Turn down your radio, G. Chamomile. Here comes the listener plug. Keep sending us your comments and ideas to onthemedia.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
When 8-year-old Jesse Arbogast had his arm surgically reattached after a shark attack, it was a medical story. But when a Florida man was attacked 8 miles from Jesse, cable news practically declared Shark Week. Reporters doing stand-ups while wading in the ocean, public officials urging calm, calm. And at the center of the feeding frenzy was Michael Capuzzo. Why Capuzzo? Because he's the author of Close to Shore, a recently published book about a famous American shark attack. Since the recent attacks, he's been on dozens of TV and radio shows, including this one. Michael Capuzzo, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Your shark attack book has been made current by shark attacks. How do you feel? Imagine me thrusting the microphone into your face, you know?
Yeah, right. I feel, stunned. There's really no connection between the events except the pattern making that we give it. I think that there's a legitimate human interest in shark attack. In fact, I think we go a little too far in criticizing this kind of coverage.
Hate to rub your nose in this, but it must be pretty awkward watching the royalties stack up, thanks largely to the tragedy in Florida.
Well, they're not stacking up, but it certainly doesn't feel comfortable to benefit from someone else's tragedy. My wife and I have talked about if we get out of the financial woods someday that we should do something for Jesse. I mean, it seems like we could do no less.
You have no responsibility to do that, but it's a nice gesture.
Well, it feels good rather than feeling bad. I mean, it's something that is hard to deal with, and, it's a humbling thing. Certainly the fates weren't conspiring to help me. I know that, but I guess it has.
Thanks to Amazon.com, you can actually track in close to real time how well your book's doing. Can you see any correspondence between a given appearance on television and sales of the book?
It's like watching a NASDAQ stock, and sometimes it's frustrating, but you know, within hours of being on CNN last week, I was at number 5. And then, before the shark attacks, I was on did a number of national shows, from the Howard Stern show to the Today show. And, you know, within hours of these appearances, you have a tremendous increase in percentage of sales. If you look at the big picture, it's clear that the 3 shark attacks in Florida in 10 days must have helped push this book onto the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, it was on the extended New York Times bestseller list from the moment it was published in early May. And so it was selling very well. But certainly the extraordinary interest when the media does a gang-it-up kind of an affair in sharks has created more sales and is helping the book, obviously.
Let's talk about the incident you write about in your book. It was in Beach Haven, New Jersey. and largely ignored it first. What did the press coverage look like nearly a century ago?
It was remarkably good and consistent. I was frankly surprised. The New York Times was just then ascending into greatness under the stewardship of Carr Van Anda, the legendary editor who scooped the country on the Titanic, and he missed the first shark attack in American history story. His staff did. They put it on the back page as dies after attack by fish. But later, 5 days later, when a Bell captain was bit nearly in half by this same great white off of Spring Lake, the New York Times was all over that story in a rather sensational way that it sets the tone for shark attack coverage forever, I think. This is the moment, July 7th, 1916, when the great white shark as sea monster enters the public consciousness in the 20th century, because there on the front page of the Times, along with the elegant headlines just like they are today, small and fairly contained about the Somme and President Wilson's re-election bid, is this sort of New York Post headline dropped in, you know, man cut in half by shark. People run screaming from beach. There really doesn't seem to be any way to tell it any other way.
Now, I noticed that the stories that were done on the Florida attacks were generally calming in tone, suggesting to viewers that they needn't be afraid in general to go into the water. And yet they had titles like When Sharks Attack! Exclamation point. A little passive-aggressive in your judgment, a little hypocritical?
No, like I say, the truth of shark attack is it has an exclamation point on it. You know, it is a living, undiminished by science or modern time sea monster that's capable of devouring human beings. I know that there's a lot of hand-wringing in newspapers nowadays, which I have a great deal of fondness for, being a former reporter, about excessive coverage of these kinds of stories. But I think actually it's a chance, as could be a call to print journalists, to more aggressively cover these kinds of stories and take this mantle of exciting human interest stories back from television. If television isn't doing it right, let's do it better. You know, we're the heirs to great writing and putting things in their true, ennobling human context if it's to be found.
Michael, thanks very much.
Sure.
Michael Capuzzo is author of Close to Shore, A True Story of Terror in an Age of Innocence, a New York Times bestseller.
If television gives sharks short shrift, the movies this summer are made for mutts. With Dr. Dolittle 2 and Cats and Dogs, studios are hoping to cash in on a huge market. Dogs can be bigger box office than human stars, and they are not as temperamental, as On the Media's Tony Macillas reports.
Some silver screen legends have been real bitches, like Lassie. Actually, Lassie was a male dog. His gender-bending act earned him his own table in the commissary at MGM. And Rin Tin Tin was one of the highest-paid actors in Hollywood, earning over $5 million in the 1920s. Steven Silverman chronicles famous canines in his new book, Movie Mutts, Hollywood Goes to the Dogs.
Practically from the very beginning, there was a dog in movies. And in England, the first movie with a plot was Rescued by Rover, 1905.
And when talkies came, dogs made a smoother transition than their human co-stars. No concerns about accents or unappealing voices.
The great thing about dogs is, you know, it appears to all demographic groups, young, old, no matter what color you are, no matter what sexual orientation you are. Some people who wouldn't have a dog in their house, you know, will still cry when Old Yeller meets his maker.
You know we've got to do it.
I know, Mama. He was my dog. I'll do it.
When a new canine star is whelped, it can create a franchise for the studio. Sequels, T-shirts, plush toys. Disney's Lady and the Tramp has earned $93.6 million, a staggering figure for an animated film from 1955. The remake of 101 Dalmatians and its sequel earned over $700 million in box office and retail sales.
Get down from there and catch those puppies!
This summer, Fox is hoping to cash in on Four-Legged Friends. Eddie Murphy's Dr. Dolittle 2 stars Lucky, a lovable mutt. To promote the film, the studio held a unique launch party.
Parakeets and pussycats, hear ye, hear ye. In 5 minutes, we will have the doggy fashion show.
Dog trainers and celebrities mixed with hundreds of dogs who were hoping to be discovered. The usual dog star earns about $300 a day for his human companion. Stars like Eddie from Frasier make a lot more. Trainer Jody Anderson says dogs make perfect actors.
Dogs are a working species, and if their job is to perform, they're very happy to do that. Most dogs that work in the movies are probably the healthiest and the most sound emotional creatures that we've got.
Not so for cats, says cat therapist Carol Wilburn.
The cat is the antithesis of the dog. A cat only works when he or she wants to work.
We are Siamese.
Dogs may make natural movie stars, but veterinarian Mary Bryan urges moviegoers not to overreact.
Veterinarians really do cringe when movies come out just like 101 Dalmatians, because then everyone wants a Dalmatian, and Dalmatians are not for everybody.
But their energy works well on screen. Dogs are held to different standards than their human co-stars. Behavior is more important than looks. Bob Weatherwax and his family have owned Lassie for 60 years. He knows the secret to canine fame.
You never knew Lassie was being worked. He did difficult portrayals, but yet looked as if he was doing it himself.
True talent. Meanwhile, hundreds of dogs dressed as brides, clowns, and even Harry Potter strutted down the runway at the fashion show. For many of them, it's their one big chance. Author Steven Silverman.
I didn't hear of any dogs sort of sitting at the soda fountain of Schwab's.
Hollywood is a tough nut to crack, even if you have fangs and claws. For On the Media, I'm Tony Macillas in New York.
Come along. Funky dogs. Nasty dogs.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Melissa Sanford, engineered by Scott Strickland, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis, Kathleen Horan, and Dylan Keefe. And Brian Lehrer stopped by. He, he's not the host anymore. He continues to stop by.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Not Brian Lehrer, Bob Garfield.
One more sign, feel like that. One more sign, Mr. Cat. Nothing but dog in me. One more stop, feel like that. One more stop, Mr. Cat. Nothing but the dog in me. One more stop, feel like that. One more stop, chase the cat. Nothing but dog in me.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.